Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, Lyndon Baines Johnson. Julian Zelizer is our guest. His latest book is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle Cry for the Great Society. It's interesting, he writes somewhere in the book that between the end of Reconstruction in 1956, every single civil rights bill had been killed in a congressional committee or by a filibuster. So this two-year period of time when LBJ had many of his victories was an aberration in American history before that time. Democrats had two-thirds majorities in the Senate, where they held 68 seats, in the House, where they held 295. And we'll talk about the reasons for that and how, you know, it was one of those moments when the time was ripe for this massive amount of legislation, this civil rights bill, the Voting Rights Act, and all kinds of medical bills and poverty bills. Julian is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's joined us many times before for his books and also for All Things Political. He is the author of numerous books on U.S. presidents and political leaders, policies and institutions since the New Deal, including Jimmy Carter and the Arsenal of Democracy, the politics of national security from World War II to the war on terrorism. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Professor Julian Zelizer, a pleasure always to speak with you. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
You know, after reading your book and also seeing Selma in the last couple of weeks, I am just flabbergasted when I realize how it was only a mere 50 years ago when all of this happened. And then when I read about what it was like in your book, in the early years of JFK, and certainly the years before 1956, holy cow, have we had problems and has there been violence and what a difficult issue this has been. And you would think that people would have realized how important it was a long time ago.
Yeah, I think we tend to have a nostalgia about earlier periods in American politics, that things were easier, things worked well. And certainly if you're a liberal, that getting government to help out was much easier than it is today. But the fact is, when you look back at the late 50s and early 1960s, the government was in many ways stacked against liberals. Congress was dominated by a conservative coalition of Southern Democrats and Republicans that killed everything from civil rights to Medicare every time it came up for discussion.
Mm-hmm. So was LBJ a liberal when he was growing up? Was he a liberal?
He was a liberal, and I make that argument in the book. His liberalism was pretty strong, in my opinion. He always saw himself as a child of the New Deal. He comes to Washington in the 1930s, first as an assistant to a member of Congress, then working for a New Deal agency, and then as a member of Congress. And he really believed fundamentally in the role of government to help with economic problems and to help with other kinds of social problems. And even on the issue of race, where he was slow to accept the need for federal legislation, I do think he generally had sympathy for trying to deal with the problem of racial inequality through government action.
Mm-hmm. You describe this scene where he's talking to Bill Moyers shortly after JFK's assassination, in which he outlines his fierce urgency of now in a way, which was a civil rights cry, but it was his also to finish FDR's revolution. I mean, it would appear to me that FDR was his hero and there was an unfinished business, and by golly, LBJ was going to take care of that.
It is. It's a great story where, you know, he is lying on his bed and meeting with Bill Moyers, Cliff Carter, and Jack Valenti, who are three of his advisors. And Johnson often liked to have meetings in the middle of the night at his bedside. He'd call advisors over.
Right.
Often Lady Bird would sometimes literally be lying there trying to sleep as he did this. But in this particular meeting, which is just hours after Kennedy's death and he's returned to Washington, he outlines a very bold vision of kind of moving on legislation, not only that had been stuck under Kennedy, but that liberals had really been pushing for since the 1950s. And from the start, he has this frenetic energy and amazing amazing ambition about what he's hoping to do. And it includes, again, everything from dealing with civil rights issues to passing a health care program, which had been impossible to do in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. You begin the book by spending some time discussing JFK's agenda. And it would appear to me almost that I saw this film, Selma, and it would appear to me that it almost more accurately described JFK's commitment to civil rights, which appeared to me to be a lot more lukewarm than LBJ's.
I think that's actually a really good insight, and it's true. JFK did support civil rights in principle, but he was looking at a Congress in 1961 and 62 until 1963, where there was no chance of passing legislation. His advisors, including Harris Wofford, who was a liberal, a close friend of Martin Luther King, told him right after Kennedy takes office, don't even try to do this because it's not going to go anywhere, legislation, and you're just going to tie everything up. And Kennedy was lukewarm. He didn't see it as a priority. He was much more interested in other programs like Medicare and a tax cut that he's pushing for, which will help stimulate the economy. And he really comes to civil rights much more hesitantly than Lyndon Johnson. It's not until 1963 and not until the movement has really forced the issue with the protests in Birmingham,
yes,
that Kennedy finally decides to send a bill to Congress, a substantial bill to Congress. And by then, even Republicans on the Hill are calling for it, and they're warning if he doesn't do it, they will. So I do think it's true that Kennedy was much more tepid. And also, we have to remember, he faced a Congress where until his death, there was very little room to move forward with legislation.
Well, let's sing the praises of some of those Republicans then. That was a part of history that I just didn't know very much about. There were some Republicans who thought even JFK was too slow on this. Who were they, and why were they calling for a civil rights bill?
There were. You had two kinds of Republicans. First were liberal Republicans. You had liberal Northeastern Republicans in this period, like Jacob Javits of New York, who were more progressive on civil rights in some ways than many Democrats. And they were just ongoing proponents of legislation. They were very much sympathetic to the cause. You had some conservative Republicans who were conservative on everything but civil rights. There was one guy, William McCullough, who was a member from Ohio. He was a member of the House Judiciary Committee, which was the committee that ultimately had to start the drafting of legislation. And he had always been a civil rights advocate, even though he was very conservative, from his early days when he was involved after coming back from the war in desegregation efforts as a lawyer. And McCullough, you know, agreed with the arguments of the movement and was very much eager to move forward with legislation. And when Kennedy's president, he basically cuts a deal with the administration that if Republicans get credit for a bill, he'll help move it out of the Judiciary Committee. And finally, you had conservatives like Senator Everett Dirksen, who was the Republican minority leader, is often called the Wizard of Ooze because of his long-winded speeches. And he was one of the great characters with his
yes.
baritone voice and curly hair of Washington. He was very conservative on everything and not really a civil rights advocate. But in 1964 and 65, he's really feeling pressure from the civil rights movement, as all Republicans are, from religious leaders to grassroots activists with King, to do something and to pass legislation, or chaos really will ensue. So all these Republicans by 64 and 65 are quite eager to work with the administration on a bill.
Isn't that something? So you really do have to credit the incredible hard work and the loss of life and the violence that they had to be victims of. You have to credit King and so many of the unsung heroes of the civil rights movement for making that 2 years possible as well, right?
You really do. If you're just looking at 1964, Lyndon Johnson's first year, and this is where when the Civil Rights Act of 1964 will pass, which ends segregation in public accommodations. Johnson's certainly important and very skillful at moving it forward. But really what happens is the movement is just changing the dynamics and the temperature in Congress through pressure. And some of the pressure are the grassroots protests that we know about. Some of the pressure comes from religious leaders who are allied with the civil rights movement and have a lot of power in Midwestern states like Illinois and Wisconsin, where Republicans were quite important. And they mobilize in ways we forget. They coordinated sermons, for example, every weekend to talk to congregants about civil rights and urge congregants to write their members to end the Southern filibuster. Christian leaders would meet with Republicans who really weren't very interested in civil rights, but they would tell them face to face, this is an issue that you have to allow to come up for a vote and to support it. All these different parts of the civil rights movement were very influential in 64 in allowing the liberals to break the Southern filibuster against civil rights.
Fascinating. You, were in an interview somewhere, said that you began work on this book some 5 years ago, and I quote you, "I still had a kind of view of Johnson, as many do, as someone who really knew how to work the system." And I think that many of us think that he knew people in Congress, he could strong-arm them. We have these pictures of this mammoth Lyndon Johnson who's trying to cower somebody by standing over a smaller member of Congress and pointing his finger at him. It was mostly him then. And yet, I get the feeling that that changed a bit as you were doing the research for this book. Why did we have that image of him, and how did that broaden for you?
That is what happened. And, you know, the iconic image of Lyndon Johnson is what's called the treatment. And that's where he would physically, at 6'4", 230 to 40 pounds, his weight fluctuated, hover over his opponents and his supporters and bully them, cajole them, try to seduce them into voting his way. For many decades, people didn't talk about that Lyndon Johnson. They talked about Vietnam and a disastrous president. And in the last 6-7 years, there's been this revival of interest in Lyndon Johnson, and a mythology emerged that because he was skilled, because he understood Congress, this is why so much legislation passes in these years. And the more I looked at it, the more skeptical I became that that alone was enough to get all these bills through Congress. And I really gained a better appreciation both for how the civil rights movement and liberals more broadly, unions, religious leaders, were really important to creating a Congress that would allow Lyndon Johnson to succeed. And the other thing that will happen, of course, is the 1964 election, which creates huge liberal majorities in Capitol Hill, where Congress is willing, eager, and determined to pass legislation with or without Lyndon Johnson.
And a lot of Republicans, it would be safe to say, want to walk away from Barry Goldwater?
It's a huge part of the election. So 64, Johnson defeats Goldwater, who's a senator from Arizona, who runs as a right-wing conservative and argues that the GOP has to embrace conservatism rather than to run away from it. And it's a disastrous campaign. And many Republicans in January of 1965 who've survived the onslaught of Democrats say, you know, we can't just say no and we can't look like Barry Goldwater. One of the issues that had been really decisive was highlighting how Goldwater had been against this proposal for Medicare. And many Republicans come out of the election saying, we'll vote for some kind of Medicare bill. We're not going to stand on the sidelines. So the election really creates unusual and very attractive conditions for liberal reform.
And before we invite callers, give us a sense, Professor Zelizer, of the breadth of the legislation that was passed during the Great Society. There was a lot.
It's quite phenomenal to look back on it. You have voting rights, you have civil rights, Medicare, Medicaid, immigration reform, federal education assistance to elementary and secondary schools, higher education. You have legislation for clean water and clean air. You have smaller the war on poverty, Head Start, food stamps, and you even have legislation to provide money for arts and for public radio, and even the child safety caps on medicine is part of the Great Society. So it's really a sweeping and transformative moment in domestic policy.
Mm. And then Vietnam, and then the backlash with riots in cities, and then everything changes.
Yeah, I mean, the last part of the book in some ways was the most revealing to me, and it starts with the midterm elections of 1966, where this conservative coalition of Southerners in the Democratic Party and Republicans regain their power over liberals, winning back many of the seats they lost in 1964. And between that and the 68 election, you know, Lyndon Johnson, who does all the same tricks and is still, you know, dealing out pork, can't really get a lot done. And he himself feels quite powerless. And the debate turns to Vietnam. The debate turns to guns and butter, meaning cutting domestic spending. And Johnson really suffers through a very difficult period of his presidency, even though he's the same Lyndon Johnson that we talk about all the time.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We're delighted to have as our guest. He's written another book. He's so good, isn't he? He's just a great all things political guest. And the book is so well done. I don't know if he speaks better or writes better. He does both so well that he's a real pleasure to speak with. The Fierce Urgency of Now is Julian Zelizer's latest book, just released, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. We're welcoming phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Great deal of attention on the Voting Rights Act because of the movie Selma. And of course, we're in the 50-year anniversary of a lot of the passage of a lot of these programs, the Civil Rights Bill, and all that was a part of the War on Poverty program. And Julian has spent a number of years looking at not only those years, but looking at Lyndon Johnson and his life in Congress and his earlier life as well, how his political philosophy was formed, what he hoped to accomplish, how the country was ripe for change. And we have yet to talk about the assassination of JFK and what he wanted to accomplish that LBJ took up. That's what we hear. Is that indeed the story? Let's welcome your phone calls. 1-800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And you can also find us on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for Julian Zelizer. His latest book, just off the press, The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. Frank in Milwaukee, our first caller. Hi, Frank.
Hi. Ms. Dunn, you have come up with incredibly good history programs. You are a master at this.
Thank you.
You have been a fantastic history teacher.
Thank you.
I just want to say that Lyndon Johnson, to me, is a great, great president, and if it hadn't been for Vietnam, he'd be really at the very top with FDR and Lincoln and the others if it hadn't been for Vietnam. But what he did for the American people with the Great Society was phenomenal, and he's finally, the wheel of history is turning that we're looking at him again, and it's too bad that Vietnam happened. It was too bad he listened to the military, but he helped the middle class, and the great ones helped the middle and the lower class, which to me is a fundamental Christian act.
Thank you, Frank, for your call. That is how we remember him, at least now. It's Vietnam, and there was so much more.
Yeah, I mean, I think I have two responses. One is it's correct. If we look at the domestic programs as we are now, I think it gives you a very different picture of what happens during his term in the White House. It's a pretty remarkable push for all its limits, for all its flaws, to deal with issues ranging from inequality to middle class security to racial injustice. And there was a boldness and vision, both for the president and for many liberals on Capitol Hill, to tackle all these questions, which had been basically insurmountable. And a lot of progress was made. You take something like Medicare, the way in which it alleviated the problem of elderly Americans not having access to hospital insurance or doctor's insurance is remarkable. But I'd also say Vietnam wasn't just there, too. It was also Johnson's decision. And the same kind of political strategy and political instincts that led him to make very good decisions on how to pass domestic legislation also led him into Vietnam. And I could talk more about that. But a lot of Vietnam wasn't simply listening to strategy from people like Robert McNamara. It was Johnson's own political fears about trying to circumvent the right wing from undercutting him on domestic policy.
Hmm. So he reached the point, which was amazing. When you look at what he had been just a few years previously, you write Johnson in 1968, when he looked at 1968, wasn't sure that he could even win the nomination, let alone the general election. He saw how younger Democrats were drawn to McCarthy and Kennedy. Even if he pulled out a victory, he could foresee a disastrous second term.
That's true. And you really have to understand what happens after those 1966 midterms to really get Lyndon Johnson's mindset. A part of what frustrated him wasn't the dissension among Democrats, and it wasn't simply the pressure from the left. It was the success the conservatives on Capitol Hill were having in rolling back some of his gains and basically freezing any effort to put forth more domestic legislation. And so Southern Democrats who controlled all these committees, who had renewed strength after 1966, kind of forced him into this really bitter battle over cutting domestic spending so that he would get a tax increase to pay for Vietnam, which really demoralized him and make him feel, kind of politically impotent. And by 1968, when there's voices in the left or other Democrats who are challenging him in Congress, he can't defeat the conservatives. He really feels pretty morose, because the way Johnson measured success was legislation. It was his ability to move bills. That was ultimately the measure of political success in his mind. So in March of 1968, he shocks the country. He shocks his advisors. Even Hubert Humphrey only learns about this the morning of the speech and tells Americans that he's not going to run for reelection.
Thanks, Frank, so much for your call. Doug in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Very interesting program, sir. My question has to do with Hubert Humphrey. He was a senator, and then he became vice president of the United States. How influential was he in getting a lot of the civil rights and other legislation passed? I just want your input on that, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug.
He was absolutely instrumental, especially with the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which he managed. Even though most people remember the Hubert Humphrey of the 1968 election, before he was vice president, Humphrey was really an important voice for liberals. He came into the Senate in 1948. The first thing he did was make a speech at the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia, where he told Southerners who still talked about states' rights that they should leave the party. And some did. They formed a third-party ticket. And Humphrey in the 1950s constantly was taking on all these older Southern Democrats who for so long had blocked progress on liberal reform. And in 64, before becoming vice president, when he's still a senator, he's really the person who moves the Civil Rights Act of 1964 through the Senate and maneuvers around the Senate filibuster, which takes place throughout that spring. And when it ends, you know, part of the reason people anticipate him becoming vice president was because he had been so effective on the Hill with this legislation. And early in 65, he's still important, but gradually he'll be iced out of the inner circle of Lyndon Johnson, because he is an opponent of Vietnam. And he tells President Johnson in 65, after the election, he says, "Mr. President, now's the time to withdraw from this war, that it's not a war that's necessary, and it's a war that will ultimately destroy everything you're trying to do politically on the domestic front." And Humphrey says, after the 64 election, you don't have to be scared of the right anymore. You don't have to be scared of conservative attacks that you're weak on communism. But Johnson's solution is to kick him out of his inner circle. And Humphrey's influence diminishes after that. But early on, he's a really important and, I think, forgotten voice in this push for domestic programs.
I do, too. Very important and terribly interesting American historical figure, Hubert Humphrey is. Yeah. I want to go back to this for a moment, because at the same time that we're kind of saying that we put too much emphasis on the fact that Johnson knew Congress and knew how to be a leader there, and then maybe it was the times that that were important. You also talk about when health care and financial regulations bill struck in 19 got stuck in 2009, Democratic senators were reading a volume about Johnson and looking at the congressional coalitions, the interest groups, the social movements, and the voting constituencies, which he understood, LBJ. You also write, Johnson knew the conservative committee members in the House and Senate had the power to set the congressional agenda, to put certain issues on the front burner and ignore others, regardless of what opinion polls or grassroots activists were saying. So would you say he was a master of that, that he knew the body so well, all the intricacies of it, that that made him particularly effective as well?
Well, it certainly made him effective, and I try to capture that in the book. So it is a book more about how he had this moment and how he had the right conditions. But I do argue that because of his long experience in Congress, he had a very good feel for the institution and the procedures. He had a very good set of relations with members on both sides of the aisle. Not that they agreed on things or not that they didn't fight, but he knew what made people tick. But most importantly, what he learned from all those years in Congress, and this is the part I think we forget, is the power of Congress. And so when he entered the White House, he never had many illusions about what he was going to be able to do. He said, you know, as president, power, he said, the only power I've got is nuclear, and I can't even use that. And he always used to tell his advisors that Congress gets the best of every president and that it would get the best of him. So what that led him to do was to move fast and very quickly, because unlike many liberals, he never believed the window for legislating would last very long. He knew he had to move quickly. He knew the window would shut. And he also had great respect and gave a lot of room for members of Congress to shape the legislation and to move the legislation, because he didn't think, in contrast to our image of him, that he could just steamroll them. So I actually think in some ways that was the biggest lesson he learned from all his years on the Hill.
Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, we're talking about Lyndon Baines Johnson this hour with Julian Zelizer, and his latest book is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress and the Battle for the Great Society. Julian is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's the author of many other books on Jimmy Carter and Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism, and he's become a very prominent speaker on current issues and historical issues on radio and television and also in print. So lines are open for you right now, and we would love to hear from you. In terms of the relationship, and I'd like to explore this a bit because it's been so front and center with the Selma movement, what was the relationship between Martin Luther King and Lyndon Johnson? Mutual respect or great antipathy?
Oh, no, I don't think it was antipathy at all, especially in the mid-60s. It was both respect and mutual need. They each needed each other. And I think it was a team. It was a partnership. It was a cooperative relationship. And what happens with Selma and voting rights is early in 1965, Johnson's fully committed to voting rights. The first thing he does after being reelected a few months earlier was to tell Nicholas Katzenbach, who's the attorney general, to draft a strong voting rights bill. In February of 1965, Johnson will have Katzenbach negotiate with Senator Everett Dirksen in Dirksen's office to draft the outlines and framework of legislation, which they do while drinking bourbon and smoking cigarettes. But Johnson was nervous and worried that it was too quick to get another civil rights bill through Congress. And he was worried. He had this great opportunity after the election, but he moved too fast on another bill related to race. He would cause a backlash, and Southerners would regain their strength, and the other issues like Medicare and education wouldn't pass. And so when he has a conversation with King that many people have been listening to, he urges King and asks for his help. He urges him to build support for the voting rights bill, to go out there, to expose the injustices that are being done, to build the pressure on Congress that Johnson understands is necessary to get the bill through. And I think this was their relationship in 64 and 65. I think the movement had persuaded Johnson that these issues were the right issues. And he also depended on the movement because he understood he couldn't get things through Congress without that grassroots support. And I think King respected Johnson. He knew he had an ally in the White House. Even though they disagreed on timing, even though sometimes they disagreed on the particulars of a bill, ultimately King understood Johnson was sympathetic to the basic goals they were pursuing.
Hmm. Jerry in Chippewa Falls, hi.
Yeah, I'd like to ask the professor about the North Vietnamese worked out a, or Johnson had worked out a peace deal in, I believe, August of 68 with the North Vietnamese. And Nixon campaign sabotaged it, told the North Vietnamese they'd get a better deal if they held off until after the election was over.
Yes, so that is a really important story. Not that he had worked out a final agreement, but he was trying, after announcing he wasn't going to run for re-election, he's trying to use this last lame duck period where he's no longer a political figure to try to work out some end to a war, which he understood had been totally disastrous to his administration. And he learns during the campaign that people tied and connected to Richard Nixon are trying to subvert any kind of negotiations by promising a better deal if Nixon is in the White House. There's an amazing conversation between Johnson and I think it's Everett Dirksen, where Johnson's learned of this and he is absolutely furious. And he says this is equivalent of treason. But in the end, Johnson decides not to make this a public issue and he keeps it to himself. Because he's worried about the political implications of exposing this, especially if Nixon goes on to victory. But it's an amazing little moment in the middle of that campaign where progress, it seems, was subverted as a result of politics.
Hmm. Let's go back to JFK for a moment. I think it's also a common belief in this country that what happened, part of the reason that LBJ was able to move through so much was, the horrendous assassination, and that some people think that JFK had all of these civil rights bills, was very concerned about Voting Rights Act, and that those bills were ready to go. Were they ready to go? Was his assassination part of the reason that LBJ was able to move them through more quickly? And the version that JFK had was similar to what LBJ was able to get through Congress, or different?
Well, there are bills ready to go, and it's true that the Civil Rights Act of 64, as it ultimately passed, was already in the House of Representatives at the time of Kennedy's death. Kennedy had only done this at the very end of his presidency when, again, the pressure from King and the protests in Birmingham were just causing an embarrassment for the nation and a sense of the potential of civil chaos. And there were other bills like Medicare that Johnson picks up on that Kennedy had pushed repeatedly. So Johnson, for most of the programs, they're not his. They're not his ideas. Even the war on poverty was being discussed at the time of Kennedy's death. He picks up on issues that Kennedy was talking about and proposing. He picks up on issues that liberal Democrats in Congress, like Paul Douglas of Illinois, had been pushing since the 1950s when Johnson was majority leader. None of this was new. It had all been bubbling up for really over a decade. The death of Kennedy is important, and Johnson explicitly connects himself to the slain president. He tells America, let us continue. During the 64 campaign, he uses images of Kennedy to connect him. But it's, I think, overstated what an impact that had on passing these bills. The reality is most Southern Democrats and Republicans were not ready to pass a lot of these bills just because Kennedy died. One example, in 1964, Wilbur Mills, who's the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, who had been blocking progress on Medicare since 1961. Every year, the administration would propose Medicare. Every year, Mills would say it's not even going to come up for a vote. In 1964, after Kennedy's dead, after Medicare is one of the really most important unfulfilled measures of Kennedy, Mills says no again. And it's really not until the 1964 election that Mills changes his tune. So I think it was there in the air, but I don't think it really explains why a lot of this passed.
We welcome our phone calls. We're talking about Lyndon Johnson this hour with Julian Zelizer, author of The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress and the Battle for the Great Society. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. He reminds us that in just a very short period of time, Lyndon Johnson was able to get past an incredible agenda, perhaps the most transformative, some have said, since the New Deal. And it included civil rights, Voting Rights Act, war on poverty, Medicare, Medicaid, immigration, liberalization, a raft of consumer and environmental protection acts, major federal investments in public transportation. So how did the Great Society happen? We're talking about that and looking at other parts of LBJ's life as well and asking you to join us. So feel free to do that. We'll return with Julian in just one moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We welcome phone calls for Julian Zelizer. 800-486-8655 is our number. We wanted to hear the voice of LBJ because we're talking about him. So this is from a joint session of Congress when President Johnson is talking about voting rights in this country. It's about a minute long, so we'll play this and ask Professor Zelizer to respond to what it is that we are hearing.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. President, members of the Congress, I speak tonight for the dignity of man and the destiny of democracy. I urge every member of both parties, Americans of all religions and of all colors, from every section of this country, to join me in that cause. At times, history and fate meet at a single time, in a single place, to shape a turning point in man's unending search for freedom. So it was at Lexington and Concord. So it was a century ago at Appomattox. So it was last week in Selma, Alabama.
Those words, that really, I hadn't listened to that speech in a long time, and the words are so stirring, and he makes you remember how incredibly important that period in our history was and remains today, Professor Zelizer.
It really was one of his most poignant speeches. Johnson wasn't a very good speaker, but this was really an exceptional speech. Again, this comes on March 15th after the protest, after Bloody Sunday, had finally convinced him that his initial instinct to wait on a voting rights bill was not tolerable. And in this debate over timing, Martin Luther King wins and the protests in Selma lead him to send this proposal. And he gives this absolutely stirring speech. He puts the voting rights fight in Selma in this long tradition that dates back to the revolution in terms of man's unending search for freedom, as he calls it. He calls African Americans the hero of the struggle, which is a big thing for the president to do. And in that speech, he ends at the end by saying, their cause must be our cause too. And at the very end, he says, and we shall overcome, where he actually uses the rallying cry of a civil rights movement many Americans still thought was radical as his own. And everyone listening understands the implications of that. Martin Luther King supposedly was listening to the speech and tears started to roll down his eyes. Richard Goodwin remembers, a speechwriter for Johnson, remembers listening to this and apprehending and realizing that he had adopted the civil rights anthem as his own. And it's a speech which has a big effect. And 2 days later, he sends this bill that he had been working on to the House and Senate to finish up its passage. Mm.
What are your thoughts, Professor Zelizer, about why this country has had to struggle with this issue and so many people have died and we're still struggling with the issue of race, not in the same way, but why has it been so hard for us to recognize the dignity of every man and realize that the destiny of democracy is involved in this issue?
Well, that's a question I think many supporters of voting rights have asked. Just the deeply embedded nature of racism in America, which dates back obviously to slavery and to the early part of this nation's history. But even after the Civil War and Reconstruction, that sentiment, those feelings took a long time and in many ways have not been completely undone. And, you know, voting rights, many liberals and Johnson himself thought would be the most straightforward of all the civil rights measures because it's about protecting the basic right to vote. But even that required bloodshed and it required brutal confrontation with police just to get a Congress that was finally going to pass some kind of protections. And unfortunately, since then, we've seen that some of those protections have been taken away by the Supreme Court.
Yes. Let's go to Maddie in Waupaca next. Hi, Maddie.
Hi. President Johnson was one of my heroes, along with FDR and Eleanor Roosevelt and Abraham Lincoln and you know, all those people that really promoted freedom and equality and caring about the poor, all the things that Jesus Christ was in favor of.
It's funny. I mean, that's the second time a caller has spoken about religion. And one of the really important themes in the book is the importance of religious leaders in a lot of the fights that Johnson was having. Now, Johnson would often invoke religious language. But as I discussed earlier, he really relied on religious leaders to help him with some of this, especially with all these issues involving race. And there was a wing of the religious establishment that was really proactive on pushing for this progressive legislation. Kind of liberal religious figures were front and center during this period. During the civil rights filibuster, a group of seminarians, for example, comes to Washington and they hold ongoing 24-hour vigils at the Lincoln Memorial, which attract a lot of media attention for the cause. And religious leaders, preachers would literally sit in the chambers, in the galleries of the Senate to watch the filibuster and monitor what all the senators were doing and then report back outside. This is before C-SPAN to tell people. They were called gallery vultures. And religious leaders literally would lobby members of Congress at a personal level, trying to get them to vote for the bill. One senator said they couldn't turn around without seeing a religious figure looming somewhere in the chamber. And I think it's a part of the history of religion that's very notable in this moment and that we have forgotten.
Yes, it is notable. Thank you, Maddie, for the call. Chuck sends an email, wants to know how LBJ transitioned into becoming a progressive politician, despite the fact that he came from conservative-minded Texas.
Yeah, he always had this in him. You know, his father, who was involved in Texas politics, had a real strong populist streak, and he saw this as a child. His first real job is working for the National Youth Administration in the 1930s in Texas, which was a big New Deal program, and he became very committed early on to how government could help deal with issues like poverty and race. During the 1950s, when he's the majority leader, he also is constantly hearing from liberal senators and liberal members of the House who are pushing for all these programs, which eventually become part of his presidency. So it's not as if he is unaware of them. And I think he becomes committed. And I think finally, the civil rights movement has an impact on him. I think on how he came to the conclusion that legislation had to be part of the solution toward racial injustice. I think, you know, he is affected by the movement in the 50s and early 60s like all other Americans. But I don't think it was a huge stretch for him to ultimately reach the Great Society. I do believe this is who he was, and it was actually the fulfillment of a lot of ideas he had been pushing for since he was a young man.
Hmm. Did he like being vice president?
He hated it. And that's the first line of my book, how much he hated being vice president. I think that was the worst of all worlds. He wasn't anymore a member of Congress where he had been a real source of power. He wasn't the president. So he was just basically sitting on the sidelines. Kennedy didn't want to give him any kind of role in his administration. Kennedy's people didn't like Johnson, and they feared him, that if you gave him a little power, he'd use it and you wouldn't be able to control him. So he didn't like not having power. He didn't like the way in which Kennedy, who he didn't think deserved the presidency, was basically mistreating him and not taking advantage of him. And I think it was really the kind of worst period in his career, really in 1963, when he felt totally dejected about where his career was going.
Mm-hmm. And tell us, your book also looks, which I found interesting, that we tend to think of the whole time of the 60s and maybe even a little before was a great time for liberal reform. And yet, when you write, at the time of JFK's death, the record for liberal reform was really fairly meager in this country. The New Deal was quite some time back, and all of these issues became so prominent in the mid-60s were going nowhere in the 50s.
Yeah, we really forget. You know, if you turn from the White House to Congress, you see that American politics was very conservative. And there is this coalition of the Southern Democrats who are very conservative on issues of race, on issues of unions, on issues of health care, and Republicans who had the numbers, they had the votes, and they controlled the committees and were really pretty good at killing all these proposals. There was one guy, James Eastland, who was a senator from Mississippi, an ardent racist, who used to joke that he had special pockets put into his pants simply to bury all the civil rights bills that he wouldn't let come up for a vote in his subcommittee. And that was the sentiment of the period. And liberals were constantly frustrated. They didn't think of America as a very liberal place. Certainly, they didn't think of Washington that way. Senator Joseph Clark, a liberal from Pennsylvania, called his colleagues the sapless branch of government. And after 1966, those forces of conservatism reemerge. And so when liberalism was at the height of its power, really we're talking about a two-year period. That's it. And I think we forget that 1960s America was more like a civil war between liberalism and conservatism than it was just a triumphant period for liberalism.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Dave in Prairie du Sac. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for the show and for letting me speak for a second. I just this is interesting. I just read Sam Tannenhaus's review of your book in The New Yorker, and he raised that little story about the 64 Civil Rights Act that you mentioned briefly, but it points out how Johnson could muster almost preternatural energy in accomplishing a task, and talk about the urgency of now. In he encouraged Richard Bolling to get that bill out of committee by getting a petition started, and he knew how to do that, but he was also able to help get people to sign on to that petition. I wonder if you could just talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, Richard Bolling was a Democrat from Missouri who was one of the big figures for liberals in the period. He was in the House of Representatives. He headed something called the Democratic Study Group, which was basically a caucus of liberals who fought Southern conservatives tooth and nail and were determined to use every little technical procedure they could find to subvert Southern power. And when the 64 Civil Rights Bill goes to the House Rules Committee, that's the committee that had to basically bring it up for a vote. It was chaired by a guy, Howard Smith, who hated everything that was liberal, who was born on a plantation in Virginia, and who had zero sympathy for civil rights. They use a method called the discharge petition. Bolling brings it up. Basically, if you get enough signatures, you can force a bill out of the House Rules Committee. That's what it was. Johnson encourages him and supports him. Importantly, it's Richard Bolling who really puts that forward and sees liberals in the House I'm talking about who are kind of moving forward with this. But there, again, is a moment when Johnson learns and is aware of this opportunity that exists and allows the liberal strength that exists to move forward with this procedure.
Hmm. Thank you very much, Dave, for the call. Well, this was just a terrific hour, Professor Zelizer. I would imagine it must be quite a thing to be so involved in somebody's life, who's a fairly recent person, but actually not that recent, it was 50 years ago, to immerse yourself in and learn things about somebody who you think you know everything about. But you live with him, don't you, for a long time?
It was an amazing experience. It's someone I had studied before, but now I went very deep into his life. I listened to all the tapes of his conversations, and you know, I was able to get a really good feel for who he was, his rhythms, his outlook on politics, and more importantly, his relationship with other legislators, other activists. And you know, it's great to come out of writing a book with this sort of feel for a political leader like this. And I do feel at some level like I know him you know, Lyndon Johnson's part of my life now.
Right. Well, I was looking forward to this interview, and you have not disappointed at all. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Julian Zelizer, and the book is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, has written several books. You see him as a commentator on TV and radio and in print. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour and to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in downtown Milwaukee. I'm off for a little while, so the wonderful Mr. John Munson will be filling in for me. I'll talk to you again soon on the Ideas Network.